This is Anthony Annarino, author of The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer in 2016. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Today, we're joined by Anthony Annarino, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. Anthony Annarino is an international keynote speaker and workshop facilitator, sales leader, and sales coach. He blogs daily at thesalesblog.com. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Capital University's School of Management and Leadership in Columbus, Ohio, where he teaches personal selling, social media marketing, and persuasive marketing in the MBA program. He's also an alumnus of Capital, where he earned an undergraduate degree and a law degree. Anthony, congratulations on the only sales guide you'll ever need, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So, Anthony, I didn't tell everything to the listener about your background, and I just want to start by saying if you go to your blog, you'll see there's pictures of you, and you have a shaved head, and you look a lot like my brother, Bill, who in high school was voted by the girls as most attractive. But you have not always had a shaved head. At one time, you had a lot of hair because you were the front man for a hard rock band in L.A. while you did sales.
Correct.
So if you could tell the listener a little bit about that, it just makes your whole bio probably one of the most interesting.
You know, when you're a kid and you're growing up in an apartment complex, being raised by a single mom, and you don't really have a lot of people around you with a vision that exceeds just getting a good job to try to take care of your family. You don't see a lot of options. And that was how I grew up. I had a mother that was working really hard, struggling to take care of her four kids. I was the oldest. And the only thing that looked like a reasonable choice for me in the way of a profession was fronting a rock band. I was 15 years old. It was July 6, 1982. I saw Def Leppard. And they weren't very much older than I was at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is great rock band out traveling around. And a couple years later, after going to see all kinds of bands, I was fortunate enough to see David Coverdale and Whitesnake at Veterans Memorial open up for Quiet Riot, who did not do so well following Whitesnake. But when I just saw the way women reacted to David Coverdale, it was my senior year of high school. And I thought, I am starting a rock band immediately, if not sooner. There were no cell phones in 1984. But the next day I called my brother on a landline and said, we're starting a rock band. And we did. And things worked out exactly as I hoped they would. We did really well. We could play big clubs. And we ended up doing well enough that I decided to move to LA to pursue music. But I needed a day job. So I got a job in staffing. And the reason that I ended up in sales was because I had a mentor there who recognized that I was already selling, even though it was never something I would have said. If you would have said, what are you doing? I would say, I'm trying to help these people mm-hmm. with their big problems. I would have never said selling in a million years. But he came to me one day and said, I want you to cut your hair off and I want you to go into outside sales full time. And those are the words he said. But what I heard was, I want you to become a psychopathic axe murderer and go on a killing spree in the greater Los Angeles area. Uh-huh. Because that's what I thought salespeople were. I thought they were manipulative, selfish, you know, egocentric, pushy. I had all these stereotypes in my mind that really only came from my interaction with two or three car salespeople. Mm-hmm. And he got me in a trap basically by saying, you know, all those things that you said to describe salespeople, is that how you're winning the accounts that you're winning? And I thought, no, it's not. But I didn't come to LA to cut my hair off and become a salesperson. And through a turn of events over a weekend at a bar called Mom's with some of my friends, I ended up finding a reason to cut my hair off. And I went into outside sales and I became a terrible salesperson once somebody told me I had to sell. And it took a little while for me to have the epiphanies that you have when you get feedback from customers, like when you read them an 84-page binder word for word and they go into a catatonic state and have to be revived because you've literally put them in a coma. It takes a while for you to get that feedback. And it took a while for me to get back to just doing what I was always trying to do, which was connect with people and find a way to help them. And from there, I fell in love with doing that work. I found that the best way to help businesses transform and get better results was through selling and helping them solve their biggest problems.
And I should add that, you know, this is the Marketing Book Podcast, but these days I don't think that marketers can get enough information about sales. And the more they understand about sales, I'm convinced they're better marketers. So I appreciate you coming on. Plus you have quite the marketing background as well. I'd like to start with an excerpt, and it's from the foreword to the book by Mike Weinberg, who, you know, we're both big fans of.
Arguably the best part of the book.
Mike would probably say no, but Mike is the author of New Sales Simplified and Sales Management Simplified. He's been on the show, and not to throw a challenge down to you, Anthony, but his show is the most downloaded of this podcast ever.
Until now.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I want. I want that. So let me just read from this one paragraph, and then we'll go from there. He says, there is an epidemic of unprecedented proportions in the sales profession today. Everyone is looking for the shortcut, the easy fix to producing better sales results now. Sales leaders and individual salespeople are constantly in search of the latest trick, tool, or process, hoping to find the magic bullet. Unfortunately, many currently popular sales authors, bloggers, and supposed experts, some of whom are actually charlatans, are all too happy to offer a continuous stream of appealing, ineffective nonsense that tickles the ears of lazy, desperate sellers who are either afraid or unwilling to do what's necessary to succeed. Sadly, committed, driven sales professionals wanting to hone their craft are also sucked in sometimes. Anthony, this book is, I would say, very different from the other sales books. It's different from Mike Weinberg's and Jeff Blunn and Trish Bertuzzi, some of the others who've and Mark Hunter, who've been on the show recently. This book reminds me of the quote from legendary Marine Corps General James Mad Dog Mattis when he says, "The most important 6 inches on the battlefield is between your ears." This book was very much for me about that 6 inches, getting all that in order so that everything else can function properly and be successful. And in the book, you mentioned the sales equation. What are the three parts of the sales equation, and how do they relate to the organization of this book?
Yeah, you know, I'm a really brain-focused and a mind-focused guy, specifically having had a brain surgery in 1992 where I had part of my front right temporal lobe removed after I had a group of arteries and veins grow into a giant knot called an arterial venous malformation. And so I'm very, very focused on that. And that sets us up for this part of the conversation. It's really three pieces that allow you to succeed in just about anything. And the first piece is the mindset. And that is, what are the things that you believe? What are the things that you hold as valuable? What are the attributes that allow you to be somebody worth doing business with to begin with? And we overlook that, and we get right into the second section, skills. And we say, you know what, to make our people better, we're going to teach them how to prospect, and we're going to teach them how to close, and we're going to teach them how to present. And those things are important, but they're not more important. So they're necessary, but not sufficient for great results. You have to start with the mindset, because I could give you the skill sets, but if you're not somebody who's worth doing business with to begin with, if you're not of the character and you don't have the values and you don't have the belief structure, giving you the tools is a waste of time, because you have to get that part right too. And the third part's toolkits. And this book really doesn't touch on toolkits, except for at the end of each chapter where we give you a prescription for if you are struggling with the self-discipline that's going to allow you to succeed in any endeavor. We're going to give you some ways to do that. And if you don't understand, which the first publisher to look at this book didn't, why caring is so important and how you become somebody who is other-oriented and not egocentric, we're going to help you figure that out. So the book is basically split into two pieces, mindset and skill set. because the first half, the mindset, is going to help you become somebody worth doing business with to begin with. And then once you have that, then you need to work on the skill sets, which will allow you to be a different kind of salesperson than many of your prospects have ever seen. And I think just to touch on this for marketers, the idea of the mindset and the values is really where marketing is shifting now. And the conversation that we're having is not about what we do. It's about who we are and why we do what we do. And those start to become the more important marketing messages, especially for salespeople to pick up and be able to share in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. Let's walk through a couple of these mindset elements. And let me start by asking you the big question. What's the secret to being a successful salesperson? In other words, what is the one thing that is the difference between success and failure?
If I had to pick one thing, the one thing that would be the difference maker for most people, it's self-discipline. Mm-hmm. And the reason I start with self-discipline is because if you're going to ask other people to make and keep the commitments that you need them to make, then you first have to be somebody who can make and keep the commitments to themselves. So you have to be somebody worth doing business with. And really it starts with, am I disciplined in my thought? Am I disciplined in my action? Do I have the kind of willpower to do these things? Am I somebody worth doing business with? And I think one of the interesting questions that came up when the original publisher who asked for this book looked at it, they didn't understand self-discipline at all. And they said, I don't understand why this is even in a book on sales. And I pushed back and said, well, then you probably shouldn't be publishing a book on sales because it's all about disciplines. And, you know, the discipline to say our solution isn't right for you and walk away from that is the discipline of being honest and having integrity. And the discipline to say, Doug, I appreciate your concern, but if you underinvest in this, you're not really going to get the outcome that you need. And I would love to change my price for you, but I would fail you and we'll fail at this project together. So I can't let you underinvest, or we have to find another way to do something together. But integrity and honesty are really an indication of somebody who's disciplined in their character. And that's the first part of this book. How do you become somebody who's worth doing business with in the first place? That's the first problem. And if you go back to, you're going to talk about books here on this podcast, but if you go back and read 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, the first half of Covey's book is private victories precede public victories. Mm-hmm. First, you have to have the victory over oneself. And that's the willingness to take action, the willingness to do things that you don't want to do because they're difficult and there are a lot of distractions that are a lot easier and more interesting to spend your time with.
And I should add that at the end of every chapter, not only do you have a prescription that you should just go do right now to get started, you include further recommended reading, other books, and they are an all-star list of books. Really, really great. And in fact, there are a couple times where I would read through a chapter and I'd say, oh man, I'm going to have to tell them about this other book. At the end of the chapter, you'd have the book as a one of the recommended pieces. So I was just... It was all perfectly aligned. You've got at the end of each chapter a link. You suggest a lot of resources that are at theonlysalesguide.com. For instance, you've got a free discipline worksheet.
Yeah, there's a free worksheet, and eventually that will roll up into a free workbook. So people who pre-order the book are going to have access to come into that site and download the workbook. And it will probably extend if anybody who buys the book is going to be able to come out and just download the resources. What we wanted to do with this is give people the tools to say, okay, so we're working on your mindset. We're working on your skill set. I really care deeply that people act on what they read. If reading something and not taking action on it is the same as not having read it. You know, and knowing you need to do something and not doing it is the same as not knowing. So we're urging you to take action on each chapter. And basically, you can look at this and say, there's 2 or 3 of these that I want to work on first. And you can work through the resources and start building up those areas where that increase in competency is going to improve your results.
Mm-hmm. A couple of the things that I wanted to ask you to talk about as it relates to the mindset. One of the 9 mindsets is, in addition to self-discipline, is optimism. And one pearl is where you say negativity is the only cancer that spreads by contact. Yeah. Can you explain what a negativity fast is?
A negativity fast. This is probably, if I were to recommend one thing that would change your life today more than anything else outside of the discipline, and these are sort of stacked in that order, it's to just eliminate all negative content from entering your mind in the first place. And you talked about Mattis's quote about the 6 inches between your ears. That is the battlefield. And there's a war being waged right now to fill your mind with scarcity, with fear, with negativity. We're in an election season as we record this, and all of the content that you're getting is designed to scare you into believing one thing or another thing. All of the things that you see on the news are all negative. The news only reports negative. And what's interesting about that to me, Doug, is that yesterday there were thousands of healthy babies born. There were people who got engaged. There were people who got married. There were people that got promoted. There were people that bought their first house. There were people that had transformational breakthroughs in their lives that are going to change their lives for the better in ways that we can't imagine. None of that's reported. The only thing that's reported were deaths and accidents and things that are fear-based. So if you can go on a negativity fast and take 30 days and say, I'm turning off the news, I'm turning off my social feeds from everybody who posts continually provocative, negative ideas that they're trying to infect me with. And instead, I'm only going to pump in good things. So you go out and you buy Zig Ziglar, and you buy Stephen Covey, and you buy Brian Tracy, and you buy Anthony Robbins, and you load that up onto your phone, and you just take that in constantly for 30 days. You'll never go back to taking in the negativity, and the things that you do see won't have the same impact on you, because what we think about tends to manifest in our life. We tend to manifest it. And if you're going to be successful in every endeavor, having a positive, optimistic, empowered mindset is what allows you to take action when other people won't take action. Other people think there's no reason to try, this can't be done, or there's no reason to. But optimistic people can break through those barriers and immediately bring themselves to action because they believe that they can make a difference. They believe that the future is going to be better.
Mm-hmm. Let's stay with the mind, since that's half the book. You talk about you say that if you know everything already, you can't learn anything. Can you talk about Shoshin? I think that's the correct pronunciation. That's Zen Buddhism.
That's right.
Zen Buddhism, that means the concept that means beginner's mind. It's really important.
It's really, really important to continuously learn. And this is one of my favorite stories, that the martial artist Bruce Lee told this story about a professor who's studying consciousness and wants to understand Zen Buddhism, because those are people who work very, very heavily on consciousness. And he tells the story about the professor climbing up the mountain to meet the Zen master, and then getting there and starting to recount his great credits as an individual, his education, the papers that he's published. But the Zen master interrupts him and says, before you go into all that, tea? And the professor says, sure. And so the Zen master starts filling the cup while this guy recounts, you know, his advanced degrees, his PhDs, the papers he's published, who he's been involved with in the way of universities. And he notices that the Zen master is filling the cup beyond the amount of tea that it would hold. And he says, I'm sorry, Zen master, but you may not have noticed, but the cup is overflowing. And the Zen master says, yes, to fit anything more in, we'd have to empty the cup. And the metaphor there is, if you already know everything, then you can't add anything to that because you don't have room for it anymore. So beginner's mind is this concept that no matter what, you always have to believe that you don't know enough and that there are other beliefs that are available to you. And this is the biggest challenge for people to change. And it's, if your beliefs, if what you believed and the actions you were taking could get you the result that you want, you'd already be getting those results. If you're not getting those results, it's because the beliefs and the actions that you're taking won't get you those results. So you have to say, what do I need to unlearn and pour out of my cup so I can fit in and try on some other belief that's going to fit me better? And that concept is universally practiced by people who perform well, because they're always looking for what's the next thing for them to learn. And if you look at Yoshiba, or O Sensei from Aikido, after he was a great master in martial arts, he took off his black belt and put on a white belt as an indication of I'm still learning and there's still more room for me to grow and there's still more ground for me to cover.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A guest who's been on the show as well as on your show in the arena is Ryan Holiday, and his latest book is Ego is the Enemy. And in the book, he talks about similar concept where the more you learn, the more you realize how much more you have to learn.
Well, in my experience, it's one of two things. You recognize that what you don't know far exceeds anything you could possibly know, or you decide that you know everything already and you're going to share it with everybody who will listen. And I think that's Ryan's point. If you already know everything, there's not a lot of room for growth. And the ego gets in the way.
Yes, very much so. So one of the other mindsets is persistence. And I want to ask you to explain the difference between being persistent and a nuisance.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. There are salespeople and people generally in life who can persist and continue to badger away and ask for what they want. That is, if you're just self-oriented and you're egocentric and you're just asking without exchanging any value, you're a nuisance. What will make you persistent is to say, in every interaction I have with a client, this is true for sales and for marketing, in every interaction, I need to do something that creates value for that individual. So if I'm continuing to call my dream client because I want an appointment with them, I have to continue to call and say, listen, I have a new insight that I want to share with you, whether you ever buy from me or not. I'm going to send you this thing. I'd like you to read it. And I highlighted the most important parts based on our last conversation. Even if they never buy from me, they can value from what I'm sharing with them because the insight's worth having. That's what makes you persistent. If it's just continually badgering away and asking again and again, there's a value to being persistent. But if you add to it in this intention of I must create value in every interaction, then that persistence starts to turn into something more meaningful that somebody can say, you know what, this person really has great ideas. They really are going to persist in helping me, and they're somebody worth talking to. And that's the first half of the book. What makes you somebody worth doing business with in the first place?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a marketing standpoint, you talk about that. You're adding value, providing insights. The same immediately it came to mind is marketing automation and automated lead nurturing, where you can set up the software to, you know, continue to send things to people who've converted on your website and you capture their email address. But you don't want to be saying, you want to buy from us? You want to buy from us? You want to buy? You need to be leading with, you know, since you downloaded this, this might be helpful. And these are some of the issues people who are looking for a solution like this wrestle with. That kind of thing applies directly to the marketing side.
Yeah, and let's leave the book for just a minute, and I'll just add some insight here to marketers. The thing that you have to provide salespeople with are the messages that they can use to nurture, because the automation is marketing, and that's saying this company wants you to know this information, give you this gift of value. But when a human being does it, and it has their handwriting on it, and they took and highlighted some portion of it and added personal notes, that's nurturing. That's as a human being there actually cares about me enough to send me this personally. And I think marketers, if you want to help salespeople, understand that they have to make this very personal and then teach them how to make it personal and give them something of value to use so they can persist.
Mm-hmm. Great advice. Great advice. Anthony, there's a dangerous form of halitosis that is going around that literally melts your customer's face off and apparently makes you lose a sale. Can you explain what that is?
It's called self-orientation, and the term that we use in sales is commission breath.
I love it.
And it's a true story. I had a salesperson say, well, the way that I make sure my client knows, you know, what I want and why I'm asking for what I want and how I get paid is I share with them my commission structure so they understand my motivation. And I said, that is probably the worst thing I've ever heard in a group of 700 people. I mean, it is exactly the wrong thing to do, is to demonstrate your self-orientation. Caring is about the other person. And if you want to be a good salesperson or a good leader or a good manager, you focus on helping the other person get their outcome. And that's the fastest way to make a difference. But he thought that disclosing that was helpful because they understood his motivation. But his motivation is supposed to be to help them get what they want, not for them to help him get what he wants. Mm-hmm. And it's an important shift. because the reason salespeople have the reason there's a negative connotation around the word sales and salespeople developed a bad reputation is that they were taught to be self-oriented. They were taught to close people with a hard sell. And that doesn't work anymore. The world changed dramatically and the options for other people to buy from are limitless. And the knowledge that you have, the information parity has shifted dramatically. So those things don't work anymore. And they were probably never the right thing to do to begin with.
Anthony, before we leave the first part of the book, I want to ask you to explain, when someone describes what they sell, what is the only thing they should describe?
The outcome, specifically the outcome. And this is another area where people get in trouble is by describing the product. And what they hope is that the product is so compelling by itself that the customer will just buy. But they're not really trying to buy a product or a service or a solution. They're trying to buy a set of outcomes that are going to move them to a better future. So you have to focus on what's the outcome that they're really trying to buy. That's the most important thing to focus on. And I use this quote from a Harvard professor. People don't want to buy drills. They want to buy quarter-inch holes. And if they could get the quarter-inch hole without buying the drill, they wouldn't buy it. So you focus on how do I help them get what they really want, which is an outcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's so important. And it has enormous implications for marketing. And if you don't like the drill bit, I think I've heard about Scotts, the lawn care people would say, I don't sell seed. I sell a beautiful lawn.
Right. That's right.
So in the second part of the book, you go into a number of skill sets, and those are things like closing and prospecting and diagnosing and so forth. And what was surprising to me was that you also included some newer things, business acumen, change management, and leadership. But let's before we get to those, let's step back and talk about, because we're talking about a sales book, we're required by law to talk about the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, and that particular scene where Alec Baldwin comes in and starts firing everybody up, and it's, if anybody hasn't seen it but has seen Full Metal Jacket, it's like watching the first 10 minutes of Full Metal Jacket where Arlie Ermey is screaming at the Marine Corps recruits. And because I'm a twisted person, I can't stop laughing at either one of those scenes. And that's where he comes in as the hard charging, you know, close, always be closing. And then you start to talk about Neil Rackham's book, Spin Selling. Can you take us through the relationship of that scene from the movie? And we're going to include in the show notes that scene with Alec Baldwin at marketingbookpodcast.com and Neil Rackham's book about spin selling and how that then started making people think you should never be closing.
Yeah, there's a confluence, I guess, of events that occurred. So that movie does such a great job. And Alec Baldwin, I think, was nominated for an Academy Award for the role of Blake, which is this top sales producer that's going to come in and really teach these underperforming salespeople what they need to do. And he starts with ABC, always be closing, always be closing. And he goes on and on about
it, just like that too.
Yeah. And I've watched that scene a million times because as a sales movie, it's perfect. Yeah. And then it's IADA, attention, interest, decision, action, are you ready to decide? And he just continues to badger these guys. And it's a perfect example of what salespeople were taught to do. And it was to be pushy, to ask, to manipulate, and to do these things. And that movie, there was no better way to capture what salespeople had been taught up to that point. But things changed dramatically. And I think probably one of the best books, I'll call it one of the maybe top two, is Neil Rackham's Spin Selling, which came out in 1988. And what Rackham did is his team followed around salespeople, and they went on 35,000 sales calls. So this is a big sample set of behaviors that they got to see. And the book is a model for questioning in a sales conversation. So it's situation questions, problem questions, implication questions, what happens if you don't change, and then need payoff questions, which were questions like, if we fix this machinery and your throughput was improved by 35%, what would happen? And then I get to tell myself all the wonderful things that would happen. And he recognized this, and that was what the book was made of, I mean, the book was made to teach that methodology, but there's three pages starting on 67 before you get to that where Rackham describes something that he noticed. And this is probably the most important insight in the book for my money. He noticed that salespeople who did really well gained a commitment to take the next step. And salespeople who did not do well left a good meeting with no commitment made. And he called it a continuation or an advance. The continuation was, that was a great conversation, Doug. We'd love to talk to you again sometime in the future. Thanks so much for coming in. We're totally impressed with you guys. And the rep goes back and tells their manager, I had a great call.
Crushed it. And
yeah, crushed it. What's next? Well, they're going to get back to me. To the contrary, what happened with sales reps who succeeded was they didn't close for the final close. They didn't say, are you ready to buy? Because what his research showed is that the bigger, more complicated, and the riskier a decision was, the more asking for the deal tended to make it difficult for the customer to actually buy. It was too soon. It was too self-oriented. It was too pushy. And so you had to wait and get what's the next commitment. Well, the next commitment was another conversation or a commitment to bring in other stakeholders or lots of different things. But what happened is as all of salespeople continued to struggle, people said we need to soften the way we approach people. And we went from always be closing to never be closing. And now we're at a stage where, going back to Mike's introduction of the book, people are being told never be closing. When your customer's ready to take the next step, they'll raise their hand and they'll tell you it's time to move. And this is criminal negligence, and it's horrible advice, because the thing that we know how to do is help the buyer go from their current state to the future state. We know all the commitments that they need to make. We know all the conversations they need to have if they really want to do this. We're supposed to be playing the role of consultative salesperson and trusted advisor. So the commitments are a really important part of selling, which is why that opens up this chapter, because you can't ask for a meeting, which is prospecting the next chapter, unless you know how to ask for and gain commitments. And in this book, I list out 10 commitments that you need to gain in a B2B sale.
Oh, wait, and they're all important and mostly necessary. It's the 10 commandments needed to close the sale, right?
They're pretty much commandments.
I think that's what it says.
If you want to win.
Let's see here. Page one.
It says 10 commitments.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what?
We're not getting biblical here, even though this is a biblical proportion.
Oh, you know what? You're right. Page 126, it says the 10 commitments, and I interpreted that as the 10 commandments. You see the effect, the subconscious effect you had on my...
There will be hours and hours of psychotherapy to help you through this.
Okay, thank you. Okay, great. Well, listen, let's talk real quickly about prospecting. In the chapter on prospecting, you state that opening is the new closing. Explain.
The more difficult commitment to get now is the commitment for the first meeting. That's the most difficult commitment. The commitment to buy ends up being an easier commitment after you've gone through the sales process. The hard part right now is getting a commitment to meet, because everyone's busier than they've ever been. They've got more being asked of them with fewer resources to accomplish it. We've done a really bad job giving our prospective clients salespeople who really couldn't create any value. So they see us, well, their skepticism is you're a time waster. So we're paying for the sins of all the salespeople that have gone before us. And the ability to open a new opportunity ends up being a greater commitment and a more difficult one to gain than the commitment to actually buy. And that's what I mean by opening is the new closing. Oh, if you're a good opener and you can create opportunities, you're going to do wonderful in selling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet there's still all this admiration for people who are quote, great closers. you hear that.
There is, but it doesn't make any sense. I'll just tell you one real life situation where I had a client who their number one guy, they wanted everybody to model. And I looked at him, and the reason nobody was doing well is because all his accounts were given to him and they were doing what he did, which was not prospect. Mm-hmm. And they thought, well, he's got the best numbers. Well, yeah, you gave him every account when a rep left. He ended up taking all of their accounts, but he couldn't open relationships on his own. And by modeling him, more people weren't opening relationships. Mm-hmm. We tend to think that somebody with great results maybe is the better salesperson, but I always challenge people to take a deeper look.
Yeah, yeah. And you say that prospecting is a campaign, not an event. What's the big misperception there?
The big misperception is that I can make one call or do one thing, and that's going to solve the problem of getting me that conversation to open the relationship and explore opportunities. You have to think of it as a longer game. The first time I ask, I'm going to expect a no. I'm unknown. They don't know I'm a value creator. They're not thinking about what I do right now. They already have somebody that they consider a strategic partner in that seat. I have to think about playing a long game, particularly across maybe 60, what I would call dream clients, people that I know my solution is going to create jaw-dropping, earth-shattering, breathtaking value. They're going to look at this and go, this is what we were waiting for. But it means I'm going to nurture them over time. I'm going to call. I'm going to email. I'm going to send them ideas. I'm going to do all these things that allow me to develop a relationship as somebody who can help.
Mm-hmm. You know, on the topic of dream client, can you explain what a dream client is and why it is so effective for sales? And yet it sounds like there's not a lot of people even thinking about that.
Well, if you go back to Mike's book, New Sales Simplified, mm-hmm. I mean, this is why he and I are so aligned on so many things. You're not going to hit a target if you can't see it and you don't know what the target is. So you have to be strategic when you start thinking about who do I want to do business with? Who are the companies or the people that I can create the most compelling value for? And that's a smaller list. But I think a lot of sales organizations say, who spends the most money? And there tends to be a correlation between how much money somebody spends and whether or not you can create a lot of value for them. But it's not the only thing. And by looking at that, you're calling on companies who maybe are price driven, and maybe their business model, because Walmart's their largest customer, you know, they have to have the absolute lowest price. Well, if that's not your value prop, they can't be on your list. They're not a dream client for you because they can never make the kind of investment that you need them to make. But when you do that work and you get super focused, wherever you tend to focus and spend your time, that's where you tend to get the best results. And I think that taking that first step, which Mike and I both agree on, is to figure out who that is and then spend your time pursuing those clients, because that's where you're going to make the biggest difference. And honestly, Doug, that's where the work feels meaningful and it feels like you're doing something purposeful. You're actually making a contribution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you can see the target, you're much more likely to hit it. Can you explain the concept of third generation sales skills that you talk about in the book?
Well, yeah, let's do just a quick setup. The first generation we've been doing since there was a Silk Road into, you know, India and China from the Middle East. And this is, can I ask you to buy? Can I find some people who would buy? And can I tell a good story? Can I present why they should buy this? We've been doing that for thousands and thousands of years. As we got more sophisticated and we get into the industrial age and we're able to make lots of products, it becomes more important that we diagnose what kind of solution we need to develop, what the challenges are, and we need to negotiate around what value is and how much we get to capture. There is always haggling, but these kinds of negotiations at the second level skills tend to be of greater importance. And now we're at what I would call the third generation of sales skills. And that starts with business acumen. Can you actually help me? Do you have the knowledge and the situational knowledge or experiences to understand what I need to do, why I need to do it, what my choices are, what my trade-offs should be, whose help we need? And those kinds of things start to become more important. And the other two things outside of business acumen, how do you build consensus? How do you help an organization change? Changing an individual is problematic. Changing an organization is extraordinarily problematic because you have so many competing interests and people that are entrenched in the status quo and defend it. There's a lot of moving parts there. So that's a higher level skill. And then leadership tends to be a skill that salespeople need to have. That's a much higher level skill to develop. It means that I have to own outcomes. I have to be accountable for things that I own the outcome, but I don't own the transactions. So when I don't own the transactions, what do I have to do? I have to help other people own those transactions and make sure these things get done. So that means I have to be a leader in my own company. And then I also have to help lead inside my client's company. And that's a very different level of skill sets than has been required at any time before.
Yeah. And on the topic of change, one of my favorite chapters was an entire chapter on change management. Can you explain, explain what it is and why salespeople who don't understand it are less successful?
I think it's because they get one stakeholder that they think is their power sponsor and that's actually where the deal is going to occur. And in smaller deals, that might be true. But I think that the tendency for companies is for, you know, the metaphor that I love is the Matrix, is the taking the red pill or taking the blue pill. Mm-hmm. And when they take the blue pill, they can stay where they are.
Status quo.
I don't have to change. Mm-hmm. I can go back, and there's a great scene where Joey Pants, the actor, decides to take the blue pill in the Matrix just to say, I don't want to know anything that's going on. I just want a nice steak dinner and a glass of wine, mm-hmm. and I want to go on with my life. That's what a lot of stakeholders look like. So I don't think that we tend to view this problem widely enough to say, to get a deal today, the decision's more than likely going to be made democratically because we want people's buy-in and we want them to own the outcome with us. And I would tell you the skill sets are different because you've got to figure out who the decision makers are. There's not a decision maker, there's decision makers. So we have to go find those people and figure out what they want. And then we have to find out how do we serve them? Because when we do something that's changed, it's disruptive. It means that they have to change. So we need to understand what their world is. We have to figure out what the conflicts are and what the constraints are. And we have to help figure out how to mitigate those so that we can say, look, we can go through this change, but it doesn't have to be as painful as you think. And we can make these kinds of trade-offs together. But too much of the time we focus specifically on the stakeholder or the decision maker.
Yeah, who said they were the decision maker.
Who, and they may be. And I still think there is somebody who's going to sign a contract. But it's not enough to get consensus. And so this change management is how do you look inside an organization and find the people who you need to help you and then get consensus around what the right thing to do is. And consensus isn't unanimity. It isn't that everybody says, yes, I agree. It means that some people say, even though I disagree and even though I don't like it and even though I mean it's I have to change, I understand that it's for the greater good of the company and it's for the greater good of the outcomes we're trying to achieve. So I'm going to work with you and figure this out.
Yeah. And one of the best lines in the chapter was when you say, you talk about build and sell the case for killing the status quo.
Yeah.
That's where I was thinking about the Challenger customer, which I get to the end of the chapter. And yes, you recommend that book. And that book goes into even greater depth. And I think in that book, the expression they were using is show that the pain of same is greater than the pain of change. So it just really resonated with me. And I,
it's one of my favorite quotes from General Eric Shinseki. If you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance even less.
Yes, that's a great one.
And you know, that's it. So if you want to disappear, if you want to be irrelevant, if you want to go extinct, don't change. But we live in an age that I call the disruptive age, and we're going to continue to have economic change and political change and social change. This technology is going to change everything. And we are, in my opinion, just paving the cow paths right now. We haven't even really decided what this technology is capable of and what it's going to do. But if you're not willing to change, it's going to be really ugly because this is all about now adaptation. Mm-hmm. It's about our willingness to say, I'm going to do something different because what we're going to do is going to be untenable over the long term. Mm-hmm. One last thought on that. When I went to Harvard Business School, all they talked about in competition in strategy class was a sustainable competitive advantage. And now the sustainable competitive advantage is the idea to create another unsustainable competitive advantage temporarily while I work on another unsustainable competitive advantage. And you're watching companies that get this, like Apple, cannibalize their success by creating the next success because they know that what they do is going to be obsolete very quickly in this kind of an age.
Mm. Hmm. Anthony, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope it would be that they walk away from this book with the belief that if they work on being a person worth buying from, that's going to help them sell more than anything else. And if they add to that a little bit of help and a few skills that will differentiate them and allow them to make a bigger difference, they can wildly succeed in sales. Mm,
well said. We've talked about some other books. What books have inspired your working career?
Oh, there's so many. Doug, you saw my
book. This is the unfair questions portion of the podcast.
So let me make some additional recommendations.
Great.
Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People and First Things First should be mandatory reading. There's a little book that's recommended in that discipline chapter by an Aikido master named George Leonard called Mastery. That is a wonderful book on how you really produce results. And I think that those books should be required reading for anyone who wants to succeed and anyone who wants to work with other people, because it helps you become the kind of person that other people will be attracted to working with in anything. There's some books that I would say are way outside of what would be recommended on a sales or a marketing podcast, but there's a book by Howard Bloom called The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Expedition into the Forces of History, which is really a guide to understanding memes and memetics and cultures and some of the underlying forces that allow people or cause people to believe and behave certain ways. So that's a book I would absolutely put on the list. And it's a fun book full of stories. Influenced by Robert Cialdini is another instrumental book worth reading to understand how reciprocity and consistency and social proof work on us and how we can ethically use those in our business practices. And then if you want to get way, way out on the far end, anything by Ken Wilber, probably starting with Theory of Everything, those kinds of books. If you really want to understand the real forces of history and culture and consciousness and a real understanding of why people do what they do on large scales, those kinds of books are instrumental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should add, you've had him on your podcast recently.
I did a 2-hour interview with Ken, and we'll probably do another 2 hours together in a few months after we give people a chance to recover from the first 2 hours of Ken's work.
Yeah,
and probably the best way for anybody to get introduced to Ken's work is Cosmic Consciousness with a K, which is an audio book, and it's not really a book. It's an interview where a woman named Tammy Simon from Sounds True Productions interviews him for 12 hours, and you get his humor. And you get his humor more than you get in a book, and that makes it a lot more enjoyable.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll make sure to include links to all of those in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Anthony, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
I've got so many friends who have written books that I get to see before most people do. You know, so High Profit Prospecting by Mark Hunter.
Yes, he's been on the show.
That's a great book.
We talked about that one. Yeah, fantastic.
Jeb Blunt is right now writing EQ Sales, and this is going to be, I mean, Fanatical Prospecting is off the rails successful. If you look at hot new releases in sales and selling today, it's been number one since that book came out, and nothing has knocked it out of that spot.
And it is fantastic. He's been on the show as well, and it just blew me away.
Sales EQ is going to be even better and more fundamental in success than that book. Joel Conrath has a new book coming out in November, and it's really about effectiveness and productivity. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited for that book. That's going to be a really, really good book. And it's another one of those things that's going to help people with what they need to do to transition and improve better results right now when we're overwhelmed and overworked and under great stress. Her recipe there is going to be super helpful.
Yeah, I think the title is More Sales, Less Time.
Yeah. Yeah, and isn't that interesting? Because you know that everything's still going to take time. And she's going to show you how to do that, which she's terrific. It's going to be a great book.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
The best thing to do is to go to thesalesblog.com. That's my home base on the internet, and that's where I publish every day. If they want to learn about the book, you can go to preorder.theonlysalesguide.com, and that will give you some information about the book and pre-order stuff. In the future, it will just be theonlysalesguide.com will get you there.
Okay, great. The name of the book is The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. The author is Anthony Anarino. Anthony, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
And that closes the book on episode 91 of the Marketing Book Podcast. But please don't let the end of this episode be the end of what you can learn about modern marketing. Visit marketingbookpodcast.com for links to all the things we talked about in this interview and access to free marketing guides from my agency. And while there, make sure to sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. Now, enough about me. What about you? Who are you? Where are you listening? I love hearing from listeners like you from around the world each week. So if I can answer any questions or help point you in the right direction to get you the information you need, please don't hesitate to ask. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave me a message or tweet at me. My Twitter handle is @marketingbook. And please join us next time as we talk with Nicholas Webb about his new book, What Customers Crave, How to Create Relevant and Memorable Experiences at Every Touch Point. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.